And the South, Texas, the Midwest. You got your Sears Roebuck catalogue and you're sent away. That's how Oswald got his shooter. Usually that banjo tuning was used on a guitar for slide playing or bottleneck. An open tuning simply means the guitar is pre-tuned to a ready-made major chord. But there are different kinds and configurations. I've been working on open D and open E. I learned then that Don Everly, one of the finest rhythm players, used open tuning on Wake Up Little Susie and Bye Bye Love. He just used the bar chord, the finger across the neck. Roy Cooder was the first cat I actually saw play the open G chord. I have to say I tip my hat to Roy Cooder. He showed me the open G tuning. But he was using it strictly for slide playing, and he still had the bottom string. That's what most blues players use open tunings for. They use it for slide. And I decided that was too limiting. I found the bottom string got in the way. I figured out after a bit that I didn't need it. It would never stay in tune, and it was out of whack for what I wanted to do. So I took it off, and I used the fifth string, the A string, as the bottom note. You didn't have to worry about bashing that bottom string and setting up harmonics and stuff you didn't need. I started playing chords on the open tuning, which was new ground. You change one string, and suddenly you've got a whole new universe under your fingers. Anything you thought you knew, it's gone out the window. Nobody thought about playing minor chords in an open major tuning, because you've got to really dodge about a bit. You have to rethink your whole thing. As if your piano was turned upside down, and the black notes were white, and the white notes were black. So you had to retune your mind and your fingers, as well as the guitar. The minute you've tuned a guitar, or any other instrument, to one chord, you've got to work your way around it. You're out of the realms of normal music. You're out the Limpopo with Yellow Jack. The beauty, the majesty of the five-string open G tuning for an electric guitar is that you've only got three notes. The other two are repetitions of each other an octave apart. It's tuned G, D, G, B, D. Certain strings run through the whole song, so you get a drone going all the time. And because it's electric, they reverberate. Only three notes, but because of these different octaves, it fills the whole gap between bass and top notes with sound. It gives you this beautiful resonance and ring. I found working with open tunings, there's a million places you don't need to put your fingers. The notes are there already. You can leave certain strings wide open. It's finding the spaces in between makes open tuning work. And if you're working the right chord, you can hear this other chord going on behind it, which actually you're not playing. It's there. It defies logic. And he's just lying there saying, fuck me. And it's a matter of the same old cliche in that respect. It's what you leave out that counts. Yeah. Let it go so that one note harmonizes off the other. And so even though you've now changed your fingers to another position, that note is still ringing. And you can even let it hang there. It's called the drone note, or at least that's what I call it. The sitar works on similar lines. Sympathetic ringing, or what they call the sympathetic strings. Logically, it shouldn't work. But when you play it, and that note keeps ringing, even though you've now changed to another chord, you realize But that is the root note of the whole thing you're trying to do. It's the drone. I just got fascinated by relearning the guitar. It really invigorated me. It was like a different instrument in a way. And literally, too. I had to have the 5-string guitars made for me. I've never wanted to play like anybody else, except when I was first starting, when I wanted to be Scotty Moore or Chuck Berry. After that, I wanted to find out what the guitar or the piano could teach me. The 5-string took me back to the tribesmen of West Africa. They had a very similar instrument, sort of a 5-string, kind of like a banjo, but they would use the same drone, a thing to set up other voices and drums over the top. Always underneath it was this underlying one note that went through it. And you listen to some of that meticulous Mozart stuff and Vivaldi, and you realize that they knew that too. They knew when to leave one note just hanging up there, where it illegally belongs, and let it dangle in the wind and turn a dead body into a living beauty. Gus used to point it out to me. Just listen to that one note hanging there. All the other stuff that's going on underneath is crap, but that one note makes it sublime. It's something primordial in the way we react to pulses without even knowing it. We exist on a rhythm of 72 beats a minute. The train, apart from getting them from the Delta to Detroit, became very important to blues players because of the rhythm of the machine, the rhythm of the tracks. And then when you cross onto another track, the beat moves. It echoes something in the human body. So then when you have machinery involved, like trains and drones, all of that is still built in as music inside us. The human body will feel rhythms, even when there's not one. Listen to Mystery Train by Elvis Presley. One of the great rock and roll tracks of all time, not a drum on it. It's just a suggestion, because the body will provide the rhythm. Rhythm really only has to be suggested. It doesn't have to be pronounced. This is where they got it wrong with this rock and that rock. It's got nothing to do with rock. It's to do with roll. 5-strings cleared out the clutter. It gave me the licks and laid on textures. You could almost play the melody through the chords because of the notes you can throw in. And suddenly, instead of it being 2 guitars playing, it sounds like a goddamn orchestra. Or you can no longer tell who's playing what, and hopefully if it's really good, no one will care. It's just fantastic. It was like scales falling from your eyes and from your ears at the same time. It broke open the dam. Ian Stewart used to refer to us affectionately as my little 3-chord wonders. But it is an honourable title. Okay, this song has got 3 chords, right? What can you do with those 3 chords? Tell it to John Lee Hooker. Most of his songs are on 1 chord. Howling Wolf stuff, 1 chord. And Bo Diddley. It was listening to them that made me realize that silence was the canvas. Filling it all in and speeding about all over the place was certainly not my game, and it wasn't what I enjoyed listening to. With 5 strings, you can be sparse. That's your frame. It's what you work on. Start me up. Can't you hear me knocking? Honky tonk women. All leave those gaps between the chords. That's what I think Heartbreak Hotel did to me. It was the first time I'd heard something so stark. I wasn't thinking like that in those days, but that's what hit me. It was the incredible depth. Instead of everything being filled in with curlicues, to a kid of my age back then, it was startling. With a five string, it was just like turning a page. There's another story, and I'm still exploring. My man, Waddy Wachtel, guitar player extraordinaire, interpreter of my musical gropings, ace up the sleeve of the expensive winos, has something to say on this topic. Take the floor, Wads. Keith and I come to the guitar with a very similar approach. It's funny. I sat with Don Everly one night. Don was a real drinker at that point. And I said, Don, I gotta ask you something. I've known every song you guys have ever done. That's why I got the job in their band. I know every vocal part, I know every guitar part. Except, I said, there's something I've never understood on your first single, Bye Bye Love. And that's the intro. What the fuck is that sound, man? Who's playing that guitar that starts that song? And Don Everly goes, oh, that was just this G-tuning that Bo Diddley showed me. I went, excuse me, I'm sorry, what did you say? And he had a guitar, so he's putting it in the open G-tuning, and he goes, yeah, it was me. And he plays it, and I go, oh my fucking word, that's it. It's you, it was you. I remember when I discovered this weird tuning, as it seemed to me then, Keith had adopted. In the early 70s, I went to England with Linda Ronstadt, and we walked into Keith's house in London, and there's this Strat sitting on a stand with five strings on it. And I'm like, what happened to that thing? What's wrong with that? And he goes, that's my whole deal. What is? He goes, the five string open G tuning. I went, open G tuning? Wait a minute. Don Everly told me about an open G tuning. You play open G tuning? Because growing up and playing guitar, you're learning Stone songs to play in bars. But you know something's wrong. You're not playing them right. There's something missing. I'd never played any folk music. I didn't have that blues knowledge. So when he said that to me, I said, is that why I can't do it right? Let me see that thing. And it makes so many things so easy. Like, can't you hear me knocking? You can't play that unless it's in the tuning. It sounds absurd. And in the tuning, it's so simple. If you lower the first string, the highest string, one step, then the fifth is always ringing through everything. And that's creating that jangle, the inimitable sound, at least the way Keith plays it. Those two strings he travels up and down on, he can do a lot with them. We got on stage with the Winos one night, and we're about to do Before They Make Me Rum, and he goes to do the intro, and he starts to hit it and goes, I don't know which one it is, because he has so many introductions that are all based on the same form, the B string and the G string, or the B string and the D string. He just went, which one are we doing, man? I'm lost in a sea of intros. He's got so many of them. A whirling dervish of riffs. Open G intros. When I fell in with Graham Parsons in the summer of 1968, I struck a seam of music that I'm still developing, which widened the range of everything I was playing and writing. It also began an instant friendship that already seemed ancient the first time we sat down and talked. It was like a reunion with a long-lost brother for me, I suppose, never having had one. Graham was very, very special, and I still miss him. Early that year, he joined the Byrds, Mr. Tambourine Man and all that. But they just recorded their classic, Sweetheart of the Rodeo. And it was Graham who had totally turned them around from a pop band into a country music band and expanded their whole being. That record, which bemused everybody at the time, turned out to be the incubator of country rock, a major influence. They were touring on their way to South Africa, and I went to see them at Blazers Club. I expected to hear Mr. Tambourine Man, but this was so different, and I went back to see them and met Graham. "Got anything?" was probably the first question he asked me, or the more discreet, "Anywhere, sure, come back to..." I think we went back to Robert Fraser's to hang out, do some stuff. I was taking heroin by this time. He wasn't unfamiliar with it. Doogie was his word for it. It was a musical friendship, but also there was a similar love of a similar substance. Graham certainly liked to get out of it, which made two of us at the time. He also, like me, liked to go for the highest quality. He had better coke than the mafia, did Graham. Southern boy, very warm, very steady under the drugs, calm. He had a troubled background, a lot of Spanish moss and garden of good and evil. At Fraser's that night, we started to talk about South Africa, and Graham asked me, "What's this drift I'm getting since I got to England? When I say I'm going to South Africa, I get this cold stare." He was not aware of apartheid or anything. He'd never been out of the United States. So when I explained it to him about apartheid and sanctions and nobody goes there, they're not being kind to the brothers, he said, "Ah, just like Mississippi." And immediately, "Well, fuck that." He quit that night. He was supposed to leave the next day for South Africa. So I said, "You can stay here." And we lived with Graham for months and months, certainly the rest of that summer of 1968, mostly at Redlands. Within a day or two, I thought I'd known him all my life. It was an immediate recognition. What we could have done if we'd known each other earlier. We just sat around one night, and 5 nights later, we're still sitting up talking and catching up on old times, which was 5 nights ago. And we played music without stopping. Sat around the piano or with guitars and just went through the country songbook. Plus some blues and a few ideas on top. Graham taught me country music, how it worked. The difference between the Bakersfield style and the Nashville style. He played it all on piano. Merle Haggard, Sing Me Back Home, George Jones, Hank Williams. I learnt the piano from Graham and started writing songs on it. Some of the seeds he planted in the country music area are still with me, which is why I can record a duet with George Jones with no compunction at all. I know I've had a good teacher in that area. Graham was my mate, and I wish he'd remain my mate for a lot longer. It's not often you can lie around on a bed with a guy having cold turkey in tandem and still get along. But that is a later story. Of the musicians I know personally, although Otis Redding, who I didn't know, fits this too, the two who had an attitude towards music that was the same as mine were Graham Parsons and John Lennon. And that was, whatever bag the business wants to put you in is immaterial. It's just a selling point, a tool that makes it easier. You're going to get chowed into this pocket or that pocket because it makes it easier for them to make charts up and figure out who's selling. But Graham and John were really pure musicians. All they liked was music, and then they got thrown into the game. And when that happens, you either start to go for it or you fight it. Some people don't even realize how the game works. And Graham was a bold man. This guy never had a hit record. Some good sellers, but nothing to point to. Yet his influence is stronger now than ever. Basically, you wouldn't have had Waylon Jennings. You wouldn't have had all of that outlaw movement without Gram Parsons. He showed them a new approach. That country music isn't just this narrow thing that appeals to rednecks. He did it single-handed. He wasn't a crusader or anything like that. He loved country music, but he really didn't like the country music business and didn't think it should be angled just at Nashville. The music's bigger than that. It should touch everybody. Gram wrote great songs. A Song for You, Hickory Wind, $1,000 Wedding, great ideas. He could write you a song that came right round the corner and straight in the front, up the back with a little curve on it. I've been writing about a guy that builds cars, and then you listen to it, and it's a story. The New Soft Shoe, written about Mr. Cord, innovative creator of the beautiful Cord automobile, built on his own dime and deliberately crushed out by the triumvirate of Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors. Gram was a storyteller, but he also had this unique thing that I've never seen any other guy do. He could make bitches cry. Even hardened waitresses in the Palomino bar who'd heard it all. He could bring tears to their eyes, and he could bring that melancholy yearning. Guys he could rub pretty hard too, but his effect on women was phenomenal. He wasn't boo-hoo, he was heartstrings. He had a unique hold on a particular string, the female heart. My feet were soaking from walking through tears. I remember well the trip with Mick and Marianne and Graham to Stonehenge under Chrissy Gibbs' leadership early one morning. A jaunt photograph by Michael Cooper. The pictures are also a record of the early days of my friendship with Graham. Gibby recalls it thus. We started off very early from some club in South Kensington, set off about 2 or 3 in the morning in Keith's Bentley, and we walked from where Stephen Tennant lived, from Wilsford, across a sort of track to Stonehenge, in order to approach it in a properly reverent manner and watch the dawn come up there, and we were all gibbering with acid. We had breakfast in one of the Salisbury pubs. Lots of acid freaks trying to dismember kippers, get the spine out. Imagine that if you can. And like all these things one does on acid, it seemed to take a very long time. But actually, it took about 30 seconds. No one's ever got a kipper cleaner or more swiftly. It's difficult to put those middle and late 60s together because nobody quite knew. A different kind of fog descended, and much energy was around, and nobody quite knew what to do with it. Of course, being so stoned all the time and experimenting, everybody, including me, had these vague, half-baked ideas. You know, things are changing. Yeah, but for what? For where? It was getting political in 1968. No way to avoid that. It was getting nasty, too. Heads were getting beaten. The Vietnam War had a lot to do with turning it around. Because when I first went to America, they started drafting the kids. Between 64 and 66, and then 67, the attitude of American youth was taking drastic turns. And then when you got the killings at Kent State in May of 1970... it turned really sour. The side effects hit everybody, including us. You wouldn't have had Street Fighting Man without the Vietnam War. There was a certain reality slowly penetrating. Then it became a them against us sort of thing. I could never believe that the British Empire would want to pick on a few musicians. Where's the threat? You got navies and armies, and you're unleashing your evil little troops on a few troubadours? To me, it was the first demonstration of how insecure establishments and governments really are, and how sensitive they can get to something that's trivial, really. But once they perceive a threat, they keep looking for the enemy within, without realizing that half the time, they're it. It was an assault upon society. We had to assault the entertainment business, and then later, the government took us seriously, after Street Fighting Man. A flavor of that period is contained in The True Adventures of the Rolling Stones by our friend Stanley Booth, our writer in residence on the early tours. He picks up a flyer in Oakland back in the late 60s or early 70s that proclaimed, "The bastards hear us playing you on our little transistor radios, and they know they will not escape the blood and fire of the anarchist revolution. We will play your music, dear Rolling Stones, in rock and roll marching bands as we tear down the jails and free the prisoners and arm the poor. Tattoo, burn, baby, burn on the asses of the wardens and generals." Taking Street Fighting Man to the extremes, or Gimme Shelter. But without a doubt, it was a strange generation. The weird thing is that I grew up with it, but suddenly I'm an observer instead of a participant. I watched all these guys grow up. I watched a lot of them die. When I first got to the States, I met a lot of great guys, young guys, and I had their phone numbers. And then when I got back there, 2 or 3 years later, I call him up, and he's in a body bag from Nam. A whole lot of them got feathered out, we all know. And that's when that shit hit home with me. Hey, that great little blondie, great guitar player, real fun. We had a real good time. And the next time, gone. Sunset Strip in the 60s, 64, 65, there was no traffic allowed through it. The whole strip was filled with people, and nobody's gonna move for a car. It was almost off limits. You hung out in the street, you just joined the mob. I remember once Tommy James from the Shondells, 6 Gold Records and blew it all. I was trying to get up to the Whiskey-A-Go-Go in a car and Tommy James came by. "Hey, man. And who are you?" "Tommy James, man." Oh, Crimson and Clover still hits me. He was trying to hand out things about the draft that day, because obviously he thought he was about to be fucking drafted. This was Vietnam wartime. A lot of the kids that came to see us for the first time never got back. Still, they heard the Stones out the Mekong Delta. Politics came for us whether we liked it or not. Once in the odd personage of Jean-Luc Godard, the great French cinematic innovator, he somehow got fascinated with what was happening in London in that year, and he wanted to do something wildly different from what he had done before. He probably took a few things he shouldn't have, not being used to it, just to get himself in the mood. Nobody, I think, has ever quite honestly been able to figure out what the hell he was aiming at. The film, Sympathy for the Devil, is by chance, a record of the song by us of that name being born in the studio. The song turned after many takes from a Dylan-esque, rather turgid folk song into a rocking samba, from a turkey into a hit by a shift of rhythm, all recorded in stages by Jean-Luc. The voice of Jimmy Miller can be heard on the film, complaining, "Where's the groove?" on the earlier takes. Well, there wasn't one. There are some rare instrumental switches. I play bass, Bill Wyman plays maracas, Charlie Watts actually sings in the woo-woo chorus, as did Anita and maybe Marianne too. So far, so good. I'm glad he filmed that, but Godard? I couldn't believe it. He looked like a French bank clerk. Where the hell did he think he was going? He had no coherent plan at all, except get out of France and score a bit of the London scene. The film was a total load of crap. The maidens on the Thames bars, the blood, the feeble scene of some brothers, a.k.a. Black Panthers, awkwardly handing weapons to one another in a Battersea scrapyard. Jean-Luc Godard, up until then, may very well crafted almost Hitchcockian work. Mind you, it was one of those years when anything was flyable. Whether it would actually take off was another thing. I mean, why, of all people, would Jean-Luc Godard be interested in a minor hippie revolution in England and try and translate it into something else? I think somebody slipped him some acid and he went into that phony year of ideological overdrive. Godard managed to set Olympic Studios on fire. Studio One, where we were playing, was a big room. It used to be a cinema. To diffuse the light, he had tissue paper taped up under these very hot lights on the ceiling. And halfway through, I think there are some outtakes where you can actually see this. All of this tissue paper and the whole ceiling caught alight at ferocious speed. It was like being inside the Hindenburg. All of the heavy light rigging started to crash to the floor because it had burned through the cables. Lights going out, sparks. Talk about sympathy for the fucking devil. Let's get the fuck out of here. It was the last days of Berlin, down to the bunker. The end. Finn. I wrote Gimme Shelter on a stormy day, sitting in Robert Fraser's apartment on Mount Street. Anita was shooting Performance at the time, not far away. But I ain't going down to the set. God knows what's happening. As a minor part of the plot, Spanish Tony was trying to steal the Beretta they were using as a prop off the set. But I didn't go down there because I really didn't like Donald Camel, the director, as a twister and a manipulator, whose only real love in life was fucking other people up. I wanted to distance myself from the relationship between Anita and Donald. Donald was a decadent dependent of the Camel shipyard family, very good-looking, razor-sharp mind poisoned with vitriol. He'd been a painter in New York, but something drove him mad about other clever and talented people. He wanted to destroy them. He was the most destructive little turd I've ever met. Also a Svengali, utterly predatory. A very successful manipulator of women, and he must have fascinated many of them. He would sometimes take the piss out of Mick for his Kentish accent, and sometimes me, Dartford Yokel. I don't mind a good put down now and again. I come up with a few. But putting people down was almost an addiction for him. Everybody had to be put in their place. Anything you did in front of Camel was up for his ridicule. He had a fairly developed sense of inferiority in there somewhere. When I first heard of him, he was in a menage a trois with Deborah Dixon and Anita, long before Anita and I were together, and they were all jolly, jolly. He was a procurer, an arranger of orgies and threesomes, in a pimpish way, though I don't think Anita saw it like that. One of the first things that happened between Anita and me was the shit of Performance. Camel wanted to fuck me up because he had been with Anita before Deborah Dixon. Clearly, he took a delight in the idea, that he was screwing things up between us. It was a setup. Mick and Anita playing a couple. I felt things through the wind. I knew Mouche, Michel Breton, the third one in the bath scene in the movie. I'm not totally out of this frame. I used to be paid to perform as a couple with her boyfriend. Anita told me Michelle had to have Valium shots before every take. So he was basically setting up third-rate porn. He had a good story and performance. He got the only movie of any interest in his life because of who was in it, and Nick Rogue, who shot it, and James Fox, so he drove round a bend. The normally pucker-voiced Fox couldn't stop talking like a gangster from Bermondsey on and off the set until he was rescued by the Navigators, a Christian sect that claimed his attention for the next 2 decades. Donald Camel was more interested in manipulation than actually directing. He got a hard-on about intimate betrayal, and that's what he was setting up in performance, as much of it as he could engineer. He made only 4 films, and 3 of them ended the same way, with the main character getting shot or shooting someone they were very close to. Always the watcher. Michael Lindsay Hogg, director of Ready Steady Go in its early days, and later of the Stones Rock and Roll Circus, told me that when he was shooting Let It Be, the rooftop swan song of the Beatles, he looked over to another nearby roof, and there was Donald Camel, in at the death again. The final film Camel made was a real-life video of him shooting himself. The last scene in performance, again, prepared elaborately and filmed over many minutes. The person he was very close to in this case was his wife, who was in the next room. I met Camel later in L.A., and I said, "You know, I can't think of anybody, Donald, that's ever got any joy out of you. And I don't know if you've ever got any joy out of yourself. There's nowhere else for you to go. There's nobody. The best thing you can do is take the gentleman's way out." And this was at least 2 or 3 years before he finally topped himself. I didn't find out for ages about Mick and Anita, but I smelled it, mostly from Mick, who didn't give any sign of it, which is why I smelled it. The old lady comes back at night, complaining about the set and about Donald and blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, I know the old lady. And the odd time she didn't come home at night, I'd go round somewhere and see another girlfriend. I never expected anything from Anita. I mean, hey, I'd stolen her from Brian. So you've had Mick now. What's your fancy? That or this? It was like Peyton Place back then, a lot of wives swapping or girlfriend swapping, and, oh, you had to have him? Okay. Well, what do you expect? You got an old lady like Anita Pallenberg and expect other guys not to hit on her? I heard rumors, and I thought, if she's going to be making a move with Mick, good luck to him. He can only take that one once. I've got to live with it. Anita's a piece of work. She probably nearly broke his back. I'm not that jealous kind of guy. I knew where Anita had been before, and where she'd been before that, with Mario Scafano, who was a successful painter, and with this other guy who was an art dealer in New York. I didn't expect to put any reins on her. It probably put a bigger gap between me and Mick than anything else, but mainly on Mick's part, not mine, and probably forever. I gave no reaction at all to Mick about Anita, and decided to see how things would pan out from there. It wasn't the first time we'd been in competition for a bird, even for a night on the road. Who's going to get that one? Who's Tarzan round here? It was like two alphas fighting. Still is, quite honestly. But it's hardly the basis for a good relationship, right? I could have given Anita shit for it, but what was the point? We were together. I was on the road. By then I was so cynical about that stuff. I mean, if I'd stolen her off Brian, I didn't expect Mick not to knock her off under the direction of Donald Campbell. I doubt whether it would have happened without Campbell. But, you know, while you were doing that, I was knocking Marianne, man. While you're missing it, I'm kissing it. In fact, I had to leave the premises rather abruptly when the cat came back. Hey, it was our only time, hot and sweaty. We were just there in, as Mick calls it, and let me down slow. The afterglow. My head nestled between those two beautiful jugs. And we heard his car drive up. And it was a big flurry, and I did one out the window. Got my shoes out the window through the garden, and I realized I'd left my socks. Well, he's not the sort of guy to look for socks. Marianne and I still have this joke. She sends me messages. Still can't find your socks. Anita's a gambler. But a gambler sometimes makes the wrong bets. The idea of status quo in those days to Anita was verboten. Everything must change. And we're not married. We're free, whatever. You're free as long as you let me know what's going on. Anyway, she had no fun with the tiny todger. I know he's got an enormous pair of balls, but it doesn't quite fill the gap, does it? It didn't surprise me. In a way, I kind of expected it. That's why I was sitting in Robert Fraser's flat writing, "I feel the storm is threatening my very life today." He had rented us his flat while Anita was shooting the movie. But in the end, he never moved out. So when Anita went to work, I stayed with Strawberry Bob and Mohammed, who were probably the first people I played it to. War, children. It's just a shot away. It was just a terrible fucking day, and it was storming out there. I was sitting there in Mount Street, and it was this incredible storm over London. So I got into that mode, just looking out of Robert's window, and looking at all these people with their umbrellas being blown out of their grasp and running like hell. And the idea came to me. You get lucky sometimes. It was a shitty day. I had nothing better to do. Of course, it becomes much more metaphorical with all the other contexts and everything. But at the time, I wasn't thinking about, oh my God, there's my old lady shooting a movie in a bath with Mick Jagger. My thought was storms in other people's minds, not mine. It just happened. It hit the moment. Only later did I realize this will have more meaning than I thought at the time. Threatening my very life today. It's got menace, all right. It's scary stuff. And those chords are Jimmy Reed inspired. The same haunting trick. Sliding up the fretboard against the drone of the E note. I'm just working my way up. A major, B major, and I go, hello, where are we ending up? C-sharp minor? Okay. It's a very unlikely guitar key. But you've just got to recognize the setups when you hear them. A lot of them, like this one, are accidents. At the same time, Anita and I had drifted into heroin. We just snorted it for a year or two, along with pure cocaine. Speedballs. A beautifully bizarre law at that time, when the National Health started, was that if you were a junkie, you registered with your doctor, and that would register you with the government as being a heroin addict. And then you would get pure little heroin pills, with the little vial of distilled water to shoot it up with. And of course, Any junkie is going to double how much he says he needs. Now, at the same time, whether you wanted it or not, you got the equivalent in cocaine. The theory being that the coke would counteract the junk and maybe make the junkies useful members of society on the grounds that if they take just the junk, they'll lie down and meditate and read things and then shit and stink. And the junkies, of course, would sell off their cocaine. They doubled their actual need for heroin, so they've got half their heroin stash to sell off, plus all of the cocaine. A beautiful scam. And it was only when the program stopped that you really began to have a drug problem in the UK. But the junkies couldn't believe it. We want to go down, you know? And they're giving us these pure ups. Every junkie's rent was made out of selling off their coke. Very few were interested at all in cocaine. And if they were, they kept a bit back to give them a boost. That's when I first got in touch with cocaine, pure May and Baker, right out of the bottle. It used to say on it, pure fluffy crystals, on the label. And then a skull and crossbones saying, poison. Oh, it was a beautifully ambiguous label. That's how I got into all this, with Spanish Tony, Robert Fraser. That's where it all started, because they had the connection with all these junkies. And the reason I'm here is probably that we only ever took, as much as possible, the real stuff, the top quality stuff. Cocaine I only got into because it was pure pharmaceutical. Boom! When I was introduced to dope, it was all pure, pure, pure. You didn't have to worry about what's it cut with and go through all that street shit. Sometimes, eventually, you would have to drift to the bottom by the time the dopey got you by the scruff of the neck. With Graham Parsons, I really went low. Mexican shoe scrapings. But basically, my introduction to drugs was all creme de la creme. So, of course, everybody eventually had their own pet junkie. Steve and Penny were a registered junkie couple. I'd probably been taken round by Spanish Tony when we used to score for them in London. They were living in a shabby basement flat in Kilburn, and after we'd been round there for a couple of months, they were saying, I'd like to get out of here. I'd like to live in the country. I said, I've got a cottage. So Anita and I installed them in the cottage across from Redlands, which is where I was living at the time. And once a week, Steve, into Chichester, pop in a boot for a minute, go back home, and then I'd have half of his smack. Steve and Penny were a very sweet, shy, unassuming couple. They weren't some lowlifes. He was very ascetic with a little beard. He was a philosopher, always reading Dostoevsky and Nietzsche. Big, tall, thin bloke with ginger hair, moustache and glasses. He looked like a fucking professor, even though he didn't smell like one. It must have gone on for about a year. They were such a sweet and gentle couple. Can we make you a cup of tea? Nothing you would think about junkies. It was all very civilized. Sometimes I go to the cottage, and because they were mainliners, say, Penny, is Steve still alive? I think so, darling. Anyway, have a cup of tea and then we'll wake him up. It was all so genteel. For every stereotypical junkie, I can point to 10 others who live perfectly ordered lives, bankers and whatever. That was the golden era. At least until 73, 74, it was all perfectly legal. After that, they knocked it on the head and it was methadone, which is worse, or certainly no better. Synthetic. One day the junkies woke up, and they only got half their script in pure heroin and half in methadone. And then that turned into a bit more of a market. The era of the all-night drugstore in Piccadilly. I used to park round the corner, but there was always a queue of people outside waiting for their pet junkies to come out with the stuff and then split it. The system really couldn't support it anymore against the voracious demands. We were creating a nation of junkies. I have no clear recollection of the first time I had heroin. It was probably slipped in with a line of coke in a speedball, mixture of coke and smack. If you were around people who were used to doing that in one line, you didn't know. You found out later on. That was very interesting last night. What was that? Oh, that's how it creeps up on you. Because you don't remember. That's the whole point of it. It's suddenly there. They don't call it heroin for nothing. It's a seductress. You can take that stuff for a month or so and stop. Or you can go somewhere where there isn't any, and you're not really that interested. It's just something you were taking. And you might feel like you've got the flu for a day. But the next day you're up and about and you feel fine. And then you come into contact again, and you do it some more. And months can pass. And the next time, you got the flu for a couple of days. No big deal. What are they talking about? That's cold turkey. It was never in the front of my mind until I was truly hooked. It's a subtle thing. It grabs you slowly. After the third or fourth time, then you get the message. And then you start to economize by shooting it up. But I've never mainlined. Now, the whole delicacy of mainlining was never for me. I was never looking for that flash. I was looking for something to keep me going. If you do it in the vein, you get an incredible flash. But then you want more in about 2 hours. And also, you have tracks, which I couldn't afford to show off. Furthermore, I could never find a vein. My veins are tight. Even doctors can't find them. So I used to shoot it up in the muscles. I could slap a needle in and not feel a thing. And the smack, is, if you do it right, more of a shock than the actual injection, because the recipient reacts to that, and meanwhile, the needle has come and gone. Especially interesting on the butt. But not politically correct. That was a very productive and creative period. Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed. Some good songs were written. But I never thought drugs per se had very much to do with whether I was productive or not. It might have changed a few chords, a few verses here and there. But I never felt any diminishment or any extra lift as far as what I was doing was concerned. I didn't look upon smack as an aid or a detraction from what I was doing. I would probably have written Gimme Shelter whether I was on or off this stuff. It doesn't affect your judgment, but in certain cases it helps you be more tenacious about something and follow it further than you would have, than if you just threw up your hands and said, "Oh, I can't figure this one out right now." On the stuff, sometimes you would just nag at it until you'd got it. I've never believed that bullshit, like all those saxophone players who went on dope because they thought that's what made Charlie Parker so great. Like anything else in this world, it's either good for you, or it's bad for you. Or at least it has a use for you. A lump of heroin sitting on the table is totally benign. The only difference is, will you take any? I took loads of other drugs I really didn't like, and never went back to. I suppose heroin made me concentrate on something, or finish something more than I would normally. This is not a recommendation. The life of being a junkie is not recommended to anybody. I was on the top end, and that was pretty low. It's certainly not the road to musical genius or anything else. It was a balancing act. I've got loads of things to do. This song's interesting, and I want to make copies of all of this stuff, and I'll be doing it for 5 days, perfectly balanced on this equilibrium of cocaine and heroin. But the thing is that after about 6 or 7 days, I'd forget what the balance was. Or I'd run out of one side of the balance or the other. Because I was always having to think about supplies. The key to my survival was that I paced myself. I never really overdid it. Well, shouldn't say never. Sometimes I was absolutely fucking comatose, but I think it really became to me like a tool. I realized I'm running on fuel and everybody else isn't. They're trying to keep up with me and I'm just burning. I could keep going because I'm on pure cocaine. None of that shit crap. I'm running on high octane. And if I feel I'm pushing it a little bit, need to relax it, have a little bumper smack. It sounds ridiculous now in a way, but the truth is, that was my fuel, that speedball. But I have to impress on anyone who listens to this that this was the finest, finest cocaine and the purest, purest heroin. This was no crap off the street, no Mexican shoe scrapings. This was the real shit. I felt very Sherlock Holmes about it all at the time. In order to deal with one's morbidity, or in order to deal with one's levity, it was like a balancing act, and it could keep me going for days and days without realizing that, in fact, I was wearing guys ragged. I got to know John Lennon longer and better further down the line. We'd hang for quite a while, he and Yoko would pop by. But the thing was with John, for all his vaunted bravado, he couldn't really keep up. He'd try and take anything I took, but without my good training. A little bit of this, a little bit of that, couple of downers, a couple of uppers, coke and smack, and then I'm going to work. I was freewheeling. And John would inevitably end up in my John, hugging the porcelain. And there'd be Yoko in the background. He really shouldn't do this. And I'd go, I know, but I didn't force him. But he'd always come back for more, wherever we were. I remember one night in the Plaza Hotel, he came by my room, and then he disappeared from the room. I'm talking to the chicks, and the mates are all saying, I wonder where John went. And I go to the John, and there he is, hugging the parquet on the tiles. Too much red wine and some smack. Technicolor yawn. Don't move me, these tiles are beautiful. His face a ghastly green. Sometimes I thought, are these guys just coming to see me, or is there some sort of race on that I don't know about? I don't think John ever left my house, except horizontally, or definitely propped up. Maybe the frenetic pace of life had something to do with it. I would take a barbiturate to wake up, a recreational high compared to heroin, though just as dangerous in its own way. That was breakfast. A chewinal. Pin it, put a needle in it so it would come on quicker. And then take a hot cup of tea, and then consider getting up or not. And later, maybe a Mandrax or a Quaalude. Otherwise, I just had too much energy to burn. So you wake up slow, since you have the time. And when the effect wears off after about 2 hours, you feel a mellow. You've had a bit of breakfast and you're ready for work. And sometimes I used to take downers to keep going. When I'm awake, I know that it's not going to put me to sleep because I've obviously slept. What it's going to do is smooth my path into the next 3 or 4 days. I've no intention of going to sleep again for a while. And I know there's enough energy in me that if I don't slow it down, I'm going to burn it up before I finish what I think I'm going to finish in a studio, for instance. I would use drugs like gears. I very rarely use them for pleasure. Or at least that's my excuse. They smooth my path into the day. Don't try this at home. Even I can't do it anymore. They don't make them the same. They suddenly decided in the mid-70s that they would make downers that would put you to sleep without the high. I would raid the lockers of the world to find some more barbiturates. No doubt, somewhere in the Middle East, in Europe, I could find some. I love my downers. I was so hyper all the time that I needed to suppress myself. If you didn't want to go to sleep and just enjoy the buzz, you just stood up for a little bit and listened to some music. It had character. That's what I would say about barbiturates. Character. Every man who is worth his salt and downers knows what I'm talking about. And even that wouldn't put me down. That would keep me on a level. To me, sensible drugs in the world are the pure ones. Chewinals, Secanals, Nembutals. Desbutal was probably one of the best that there ever was. A capsule in a weird red and cream color. They were better than later versions, which acted on the central nervous system. You could piss them out in 24 hours. They didn't hang on to your nerve endings. In December 1968, Anita, Mick, Marianne and I took a ship from Lisbon to Rio, maybe 10 days at sea. We thought, let's go to Rio and let's do it in the old style. If any of us had been seriously hooked by then, we wouldn't have taken that form of transport. We were still dabbling, except perhaps for Anita, who was going to the ship's surgeon to ask for morphine from time to time. It was nothing to do on the boat, so we'd go around filming Super 8. The footage still exists. I think I may even show Spider Woman, as we called her. This was a refrigeration ship, but it had passengers as well. And it was all very 30s. You expected Noel Coward to walk in. The Spider Woman was one of those, with all the bangles and the perm and the expensive dresses and the cigarette holder. We used to go down and watch her act at the bar, buy her a drink now and again. Fascinating darling. She was kind of like a female Stash, full of shit. The bar was crowded with these upper-class English people, all drinking like mad, pink gins and pink champagne, all pre-war conversation. I was dressed in a diaphanous jalaba, Mexican shoes and a tropical army hat, deliberately outlandish. After a while, they discovered who we were and became very perturbed. They started asking questions. What are you trying to do? Do try to explain to us what this whole thing is about. We never answered them, and one day Spider Woman stepped forward and said, Oh, do give us a hint. Just give us a glimmer. Mick turned to me and said, We're the Glimmer Twins. Baptized on the equator, the Glimmer Twins is the name we use later for ourselves as producers of our own records. We already knew Rupert Lowenstein, who soon started to run our affairs by this time, and he checked us into the best hotel in Rio. And suddenly, Anita was mysteriously going through the phone book. I said, What are you looking for? She said, I'm looking for a doctor. A doctor? Yeah. What for? Don't worry about it. When she came back later that afternoon, she says, I'm pregnant. And that was Marlon. Oh, well, great. I was very happy. But we didn't want to stop the trip now. We were headed for the Mato Grosso. We lived for a few days on a ranch where Mick and I wrote Country Hunk. Sitting on a veranda like cowboys, boots on the rail, thinking ourselves in Texas. It was the country version of what became the single Honky Tonk Women when we got back to civilization. We decided to put Country Hunk out as well on Let It Bleed a few months later in late 69. It was written on an acoustic guitar, and I remember the place because every time you